Ready? I'd like to call to order the Carson City Advisory Board to Manage Wildlife meeting on 4 p.m. Monday, June 20th, 2016. Tamar, could you do a call to order, I mean a determination of quorum?
Chair Martin?
Present.
Vice Chair Zuber? Member Beamer?
Here.
Member Yannick?
Here.
Member Powell?
Here.
A quorum's present.
Thank you very much. At this time, I'd like to move to item number two, public comment. The public is invited at this time to comment on and discuss any topic that is relevant to or within the authority of the Carson City Advisory Board to Manage Wildlife. No action may be taken upon a matter raised under this item of the agenda. Member of the public, any comment? Seeing none, I'd like to move to item number three, approval of two sets of minutes, March 21 and May 9th. I would like to take them individually, so I'd like to look at March 21, 2016. Any comments or any recommendations from the board? If seeing none, I will accept a motion to approve from someone, please.
So moved.
Second.
I'd like to call the item. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Moving to the next set of minutes, May 9th, 2016. Any comments or any recommendation to approve?
I'll make a motion to approve.
A second.
Having a motion and a second, I'd like to call for the motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Thank you. Item number four, adoption of the agenda. I know we have one area of a small correction. Mr. Beamer, could you bring that up, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So on item number, let me get there, I apologize. Under item number 13, for the record, we need to just make that small change. The meeting is actually in Elko instead of Reno. So if we can make that change for the record, that would be great.
Yes, is that a motion?
So moved. If we can move to make that change to the item number 13 to change from Reno to Elko.
Is there a second on that?
I'll second.
Thank you. Any other comments? No, seeing none, call for the motion. All those in favor of approving the amenda as amended?
Aye.
Signify by saying aye. Aye. Thank you very much, and thanks for finding that, Rob. Disclosures. Any member of the advisory board may inform the chair of his intent to make a disclosure of a conflict of interest on any agendized item or relative to advisory board business. Disclosures of conflicts of interest may also be made at the specific time the agenda item is introduced. Gentlemen? Seeing none, would like to move on to item number six, updates on urban wildlife education and outreach program developed by NDOW and UNR Cooperative Extension staff. And that's got my name. And what I'd like to do is turn this over to Member Beamer, who actually did some pretty good work this past month. And if you could describe that, Rob, I'd appreciate it.
You bet. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So members of the board and public as well, as you know, we are kind of working diligently on managing our urban wildlife population here in Carson City. And the Department of Wildlife put out a flyer that was kind of just making everybody aware of mule deer and that it's fawning season. I thought the flyer was great. We kind of took it a step further, and I reached out to some of our local Boy Scout and Cub Scout groups here in Carson City and asked them if they would be interested in doing a service project where they go around with their leaders and their parents, of course, and perform some outreach in neighborhoods that we know are prone to having mule deer and where we know there's some fawns actually at. I did contact Jake Kramer and as well as Carl Lackey as well, and just to see if they had gotten any reports for mini deer. They were able to kind of point us in the right direction on where they thought some fawns were at. And so we kind of targeted those areas. And so we had, I think it was, the final count I got was right at about 23 Cub Scout and Boy Scouts, as well as their parents and or leaders, go out and hand out these flyers door to door, and just kind of gave them some high points to talk about. Just, you know, that mainly if you see fawns in your yard, don't think that they've been abandoned. Don't think that they need your assistance in any way. Look at them from afar and don't handle them or try and feed them or anything like that. Keep your distance because mom's probably just a couple hundred yards off, if that, watching you. And just explain to everybody that the mom usually comes back in the evening and to feed or nurse. And so it was really good. All the boys had a great time. They thought that was pretty cool. And they got to see some deer while they were out there. So they, you know, took pictures and everything. And I apologize. I tried to get some of those pictures. They took a group a group picture of the kids holding up a flyer, and so I did it as a service project to meet some of their requirements for Boy Scouts and Cub Scouts, and turned out to be really, really, really well. And I think that probably we should keep that in mind when we want to do outreach efforts again in the future. It could be something as simple as just inviting some Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts. I'll share with you, the Girl Scouts came to the Expo, Wild Sheep Show Family Expo, and I was working out there this last Saturday, and they came up to me and said, "Hey, why didn't you call us to ask us if we wanted to go out?" And I said, "Well, you know what? I'll get your number, and we'll make that happen next time." So real positive activity, and pretty proud of members of our community. They really stepped up, so.
Question for you, Rob. How many homes did you contact?
So I made 250 flyers, and they handed them all out.
Well, good for you.
So, yeah. So we made, just for the record, I made them at my office, my private office, donated all the paper and ink. So that didn't come out of our budget or anything like that.
Well, thank you for that donation also. And just for the record, for those of you who don't know, the two people mentioned were Jake Kramer, who's a local wildlife enforcement agent, and Carl Lackey is our local biologist. So good work.
And yeah, Carl didn't, I left a message for him. I didn't talk to him individually, but apparently I think he passed some information on to Jake. So, and Jake's the one who kind of put us in the right direction. So these guys really know our wildlife population well, and we should use them, you know. So,
question. Rob, how many fawns did you guys see?
I don't think they saw any, to be honest with you. I'll be honest with you. I don't think they saw. But we also told them, listen, don't go looking in bushes and stuff like that, right? So we kind of, you know, we told them, hey, they're out there. We know that there's been some fawns brooded here in Carson City. We know that for a fact. Just where mom has taken them, it remains kind of a mystery. I think that we haven't found out any information on that yet. So I'm sure there's members of the community that know that they're in their backyard or so.
Any other questions? Thank you again. And just for a reminder for anybody who's listening at home or anywhere else, there was an incident in Yellowstone National Park about a month ago where this well-meaning father-son picked up a calf bison and they thought it was cold, shivering, freezing to death. They put it in their van, got it warm, and then they found a ranger and tried to give it to the ranger, and the ranger took it. And then they tried to reintroduce the calf back into the herd, and it was rejected and had to be put down eventually. So, again, please leave wildlife young alone. Thank you very much. Thanks, Rob. Moving on to item number 7. Last meeting, we had a discussion about development in Carson City, and there's a lot of currently open space under private ownership that is going to be developed. So we had a discussion with the district attorney's office regarding if this board had any authority relative to wildlife development and any recommendations that can be made to the Nevada Board of Wildlife Commissioners. So I did check with our attorney representative and asked him if he's ready to, if he can give us an update on that, and he signified he could. So, Dan, I'm going to turn that over to you and let you inform us what you found out. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, as staff, I certainly appreciate this opportunity to be able to provide some information relating to this issue. For the record, Dan Yu with the Carson City DA's office. You know, basically what I did in preparing this overview was, you know, I reviewed the relevant statutory provisions in NRS and then also the code provisions in CCMC just to see what the scope of authority is, you know, the jurisdictional authority, I should say, with respect to the state agencies, the Wildlife Commission, and the Department of Wildlife, and then also with respect to the jurisdiction relative to the various county advisory boards, including this board. What I'd like to do is just kind of start out with a broad overview of what the Wildlife Commission and what the Department of Wildlife do, you know, as the two sister state agencies. As we all know, the Wildlife Commission was established to basically adopt and establish and set forth broad policies and regulations relating to wildlife. And then the Department of Wildlife itself carries out those policies and regulations. In statute in NRS, the legislature enacted via enabling legislation. Actually, it's a requirement that all counties also establish their own advisory boards with respect to recommending various policy adoptions and regulation adoptions for the Wildlife Commission. Carson City, this board being one of those boards that was adopted or created, I should say, pursuant to that legislative mandate. The Wildlife Commission duties include really a long laundry list of various policies and regulations that they adopt. I'm just going to list a few of these. This really touches just the tip of the iceberg, but it would include, for example, establishing broad policies for the protection, propagation, restoration, transplanting, introduction, and management of wildlife throughout the state of Nevada. Establishing broad policies to promote the safety of persons using water vessels as well. Establishing policies for areas of interest, including the management of big and small game mammals, game birds, fur-bearing mammals, game fish, and other animals, including reptiles and amphibians. The list really just goes on and on and on. Now, with respect specifically to this advisory board, before the Wildlife Commission is authorized to adopt regulations to establish, for example, seasons for hunting, trapping and fishing, limits, methods, and manners of taking wildlife, bag limits also as an example, closures of areas for hunting purposes, trapping purposes, fishing purposes, all those regulations before adoption, they must be established only after considering recommendations made by the various county advisory boards, again, including Carson City's advisory board. That being said, I want to turn to the scope of authority that's specifically set out in NRS with respect to this board. And when I say this board, I mean all the county advisory boards, including this one. That's really a very short subhead codified in Chapter 501 of NRS, if anyone's interested in reading those provisions. I'm going to go down those three main provisions, basically verbatim. The first one is codified in NRS 501.171. That simply authorizes these county advisory boards to submit nominations to the governor for nominations for appointments to the Board of Wildlife Commissioners. Two of the requirements, however, these are legislative mandates, is that, you know, these boards, these county boards, must solicit and evaluate local opinion and advise the commission on matters relating to the management of wildlife. That's statutory mandate. It's not just an authorization. It's a requirement. Another statutory mandate is that such boards shall submit recommendations for the management of wildlife and setting seasons for fishing, hunting, and trapping, which must be considered by the commission in its deliberation on an establishment of regulations, something that I touched on a couple of minutes ago. Taking all this in a context, I understand, again, that generally speaking, the state agencies in charge of managing wildlife throughout Nevada have broad authority in adopting broad policies and regulations relating to the management of wildlife. However, none of those provisions relate generally or specifically to local development standards. Local development standards are codified in a completely separate title and chapter of NRS. The two don't overlap. The authority rests, for example, for locals with the Regional Planning Commission. Here, for example, in Carson City would be the Carson City Regional, the Carson City Planning Commission. Also, the Community Development Center, which helps establish the community standards, the development standards, design criteria, so on and so forth. What that means, essentially, is the powers and duties of the state agencies, meaning the Wildlife Commission and also the Department of Wildlife in charge of enforcing the commission's policies and regulations, they don't have any authority relating to the preservation of wildlife or open space in the context of local planning or development matters. All right. And again, I have to say, just as a disclaimer on the record, that I obviously represent this board and I represent the city. However, I don't represent or have any involvement with our state agencies. I can say that I'm fairly confident, even without having consulted with whichever deputy attorney general may be staffing the Wildlife Commission or the Department of Wildlife, that my interpretation is probably correct. I just draw on 10 years or so of legislative experience when I used to be an attorney at the LCB. I believe my interpretation of the statutory provisions are correct. However, I'm also happy to dig a little bit deeper, if this board would want me to, and I'm happy to reach out to my counterpart on the state level just to receive some additional confirmation or to get a consultation at least. So again, what that really means is, this board is charged with providing recommendations relating to those wildlife management criteria for the purposes of adopting regulations on a statewide level. With respect to local planning matters, unfortunately, I don't see any statutory provisions or any city code provision that either authorizes or otherwise requires this board to provide any sort of input relating to community development standards. I did look at some of the code provisions and the statutory provisions relating to what the Planning Commission does. That's another body that I represent in my capacity as Deputy DA. I can tell you that, as we all know, the city has a master plan that it adopted a long time ago, which it amends, from time to time. I believe that the maximum number of times it can be amended is 4 times annually, and that's done at various times throughout the year, and it can be initiated by property owners. It can be initiated by the Board of Supervisors or by the Planning Director. It's not required for the Planning Commission in any statutory or ordinance provision to include or consider any impact on or impact by development on local wildlife or open space. That's just not a provision that's captured in code or in statute. There is a provision in CCMC that says, although it's not required, a quote-unquote specific plan may also be submitted as part of a master plan amendment. Now, if such a quote-unquote specific plan is submitted, then performance standards has to be included for the protection and conservation of natural resources, including wildlife. I don't know off the top of my head when or if ever a quote-unquote specific plan has been submitted to the Planning Commission and to the Board of Supervisors as part of a master plan amendment, but I just wanted everyone to be aware that there is that provision in city code, which if somebody were to opt for submitting a specific plan, then you do have to include those performance standards. So that would be one option for the Board of Supervisors and Planning to consider in amending the master plan for the city, you know, certain impacts on local wildlife, including natural resources conservation. As you all know, Carson City also has what's called the Open Space Advisory Committee. I checked out, you know, their resolutions, you know, their authority, the scope of their authority and their jurisdiction. And really what they do is, you know, they're charged with and they have the authority to acquire certain lands through their funds, their funding mechanisms. And one of their duties is to work to sustain natural resources and wildlife in Carson City. And that's for the purpose of conserving wildlife habitat, of course. But again, that doesn't really have anything to do with and doesn't really encroach upon development standard authority, you know, which again is, you know, rests solely with the Planning Commission via statute and also via city code. So again, in sum, you know, I just have to say, you know, I have to reiterate my conclusion that based on everything I've read in statute and also in code and also in policies and regulations, this board unfortunately doesn't really have within the scope of its authority and jurisdiction to provide recommendations to the Wildlife Commission relating to development standards and how those development standards on the local level would impact natural habitat or wildlife conservation here within Carson City. I did want to throw out a couple of additional options, though. I mean, certainly if anybody wanted to in their individual capacity to go and testify before, for example, the Board of Supervisors or the Wildlife Commission on the state level, you're certainly welcome to do that. I would highly advise against this board acting in a representative capacity, either individually or collectively, to go provide such recommendations, because again, my conclusion is that that falls outside the scope of this board's authority to do that. But again, within your capacity, put on your hat as a public citizen, private concerned citizen, feel free to do that. My caveat would be, of course, based on my conclusion, without having spoken with the DAG, who may be involved in representing the state agencies, their conclusion may be the same. I would say likely the same, and I think that the response you may get also is that, well, this board does not, or this commission or department does not have the authority to consider these recommendations, even from you, John Doe, as a private concerned citizen, because it falls outside of our jurisdiction. We don't do anything relating to local development standards. Finally, I would say, you know, as we all know, the next legislative session is just right around the corner. I'm sure that everyone's gearing up over there at the legislative building already. Certainly, if you wanted to make a top-down change, meaning you want to provide or see something in NRS that would specifically require local governments like Carson City to include as a consideration before establishing local development standards, what impacts on natural habitat, wildlife conservation within the localities there would be, you can certainly go and speak to the legislature. I don't think that's a bad idea, and go and lobby the legislature. Again, in your individual capacity, if you chose to do so, reach out to your local representatives, either your state assembly person or your state senator, and see if you might be able to get somebody to sponsor legislation or to consider a bill to be enacted this next session to require that. But as of right now in existence, on the books as it stands, I just don't see the authority for this board to reach out in that sort of a capacity. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, and I do have a question. Well, let me just make a statement first. I think I just heard from you that this board does not have the authority to influence, recommend, or assess, influence, or recommend anything regarding development in relation to wildlife.
That's correct. I don't see that being within the scope of this board's authority.
Okay. So I have a question then. Can Carson City, in their ordinances regarding development, enact ordinances, municipal codes, let me ask you. I think I also just heard from you that the city does not have codes or ordinances in relation to wildlife regarding development. Is that correct?
That's correct, with the exception of the provision allowing for the submission of what's called a specific plan along with a master plan amendment proposal.
Okay. So lastly, then, the question is, I think I also heard that citizens can lobby and discuss and try to influence the adoption of either codes, municipal codes or ordinances, or legislative changes.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I believe and wholeheartedly endorse that. You know, I would see that really as a civic duty. I mean, if you believe that change needs to be made from top to bottom, meaning starting with the state legislature, you're certainly entitled to do that and to reach out to your local representatives.
Well, you mentioned top to bottom, but can it also go bottom to top?
I would say no. The reason why is, I mean, just to, you know, our Nevada is we're a Dillon's rule state, meaning that the local municipalities derive its powers from legislative enactments. We don't really have any power outside of what the state legislature provides to the local municipalities, with a few exceptions, those changes having been made in the last legislative session. But generally speaking, local municipalities, local governmental bodies are restricted in their authority, the scope of their jurisdiction, defined by the parameters that are set forth by the state legislatures. And that's what I mean when I say everything flows from the top to bottom in the state of Nevada. So to answer your question, Mr. Chair, if a code amendment were to be effectuated here on the local level, and let's say, for example, the Board of Supervisors were to be lobbied, and that lobbying were to effectuate a change in Muni code that would say, or that would require this board to provide recommendations to the state agencies managing wildlife with respect to local development standards and how those local development standards would impact local wildlife and conservation. That doesn't really get us anywhere. And what I mean by that is because, again, the statutory authority and the scope of the jurisdiction of the state agencies that would be hearing this information, even if it's authorized by local code, that doesn't change the statutory authority, which would supersede the local authority. So really, that's, again, what I mean by if you want to effectuate change, I think probably the most proper way to do that in this circumstance would be to lobby the state legislature and have them effectuate change legislatively in statutory provisions.
Great. Thank you. Members of the board, questions or comments?
You mentioned open space, and that open space has to consider wildlife, the open space, open space committee. Do they have to consider wildlife as a part of open space then?
I believe that they do, and again, let me just, you know, another disclaimer. I don't represent the Carson City Open Space Advisory Committee. I've had very little to no involvement with that local entity. My understanding of their functions and their duties is really what I was able to ascertain from reading the municipal code provisions, and those provisions in CCMC establish their authority, which charges them with the duty of overseeing the administration and expenditure of funds from a special revenue fund for specifically the acquisition of open space. And as part of those acquisitions, and as one of the duties, the Open Space Advisory Committee does have to work to sustain natural resources and also for purposes of conserving wildlife habitat here in Carson City. But again, that really all relates back to its central purpose of acquiring land, not necessarily managing public or privately held lands, and certainly doesn't really have anything to do with development standards that have already been enacted in code or in statute.
So what you're saying, if I'm hearing you right, they evaluate wildlife as far as acquiring the land, but if they go back after they acquired it and are going to do a development, say construct a trail or something, they don't really have to evaluate the impact of that trail regards to wildlife.
And I think we may be talking about two different things, because my understanding is that the acquisition of public lands by, or any lands by, the Open Space Advisory Committee would be you leave it as open space, versus if you have, you know, Acme Builder, you know, coming in who buys up certain parcels of land, attractive land, for the purposes of, you know, developing it later on down the road, and the process would be, you know, they would submit, you know, a tentative plan to the Planning Commission for initial approval before they continue down the process for ultimate approval by the Board of Supervisors before they start breaking ground. Two different things. The development process in the latter part of that example does not include any provision which would require the developer or the city to look at impact on natural resources, or I should say more specifically on wildlife here in Carson City.
Any other comments, questions? Okay. Thank you again very much. Appreciate it. I'd like to move on to item number 8, discussion regarding urban fishing ponds, including but not limited to access, stocking, and predation, possible action to forward recommendations to Parks and Recreation Department or the Nevada Department of Wildlife. We're really fortunate, and I'm really excited that Travis Wolf was able to take some time out from his busy schedule. And for all the members of the public, there's some pictures that Travis will hand out. And since we're all one urban area, Marlette Lake is found within our boundary, so I guess that's also an urban fishery within. So we can discuss Marlette while we're up here, too. So, Travis, if you wouldn't mind coming up, last meeting we had a request from one of our board members that we had a discussion regarding our urban pond, the Bailey Pond, and the Cormorant use that really likes our urban pond, especially when the stocking truck appears. and Chris, thank you. You both are going to present on this?
Yeah, we can both talk on this.
Okay. And then the other urban pond I'm really excited to hear about is Marlette Lake, which you've been active in. So you want to start with, gentlemen, you want to start with Bailey Pond or Marlette Lake?
Bailey.
Bailey. Okay. Let's go with Bailey Pond, and let's hear about the stocking, the predation, and the use, if you wouldn't mind. And please
sure.
Identify yourself.
I'm Chris Urquhart, Department of Wildlife, Fisheries Biologist. And if you have a camera or something, I can show you this. Those are habitat structures that we've been using in some of our urban fisheries to help provide structure and kind of hiding places for fish to go, for cormorants to have a harder time to get at the fish, basically. We've been dealing with this issue, as you guys know, for a long time with predation in our urban ponds, and there's been several efforts over the last few years to try to help some of the issues with timing of stocking, like Travis was just mentioning, to avoid peak cormorant, you know, migratory patterns, as well as removing islands. And even in the design process of these ponds, we've removed a lot of islands that people have wanted to put in because they provide nesting and you know, refuge habitat for birds of prey. So there's things like that that we've been doing. There's also been some efforts to put a whole bunch of fish in at once and try to saturate the population and get the cormorants full so they go away and there's still fish left. That doesn't seem to work too well. This is the habitat structures we put in was a new thing this summer. So we'll see. Maybe it'll have a positive effect and we'll be able to keep the fish in there longer for people to be able to catch them. So those are kind of some of the proactive things that we've been doing over the last couple of years to try to help the situation. We've used those so far. At least the ones that I've put out have been in Bailey Pond, Mitch Park, over in Hawthorne, there's Rose Creek Reservoir, and then Liberty Pond and Fallon also. We put some of these structures
in. So these structures have been put in Bailey Pond?
Yeah, a few weeks ago we put them in there.
Okay.
And we put them underneath the dock that's there. If there's any kind of area that we can put them where fishermen are going to be able to avoid them, because you can imagine they're a magnet for hooks and lines. So we try to put them in areas around the ponds that aren't going to be heavily fished by anglers or accessed by anglers, but the fish are able to still go and hide. So like at Liberty, we put them underneath the dock at Liberty. Bailey Pond, we put them underneath there. We put them real close to the concrete structure around Mitch Park where people stand, so hopefully they're casting over them and not right on top of them. And then out at Rose Creek, we put them way out of the middle. That's a several-acre pond. It's pretty big, so the anglers won't be able to get to them with their hooks and lines. So that's kind of what we've been doing there.
Question on predation. What is your best guess or your scientific knowledge, whatever it is? I don't think there's a lot of study in this, but what is the your thoughts on percent loss to fish-eating birds such as cormorants?
There, you know, Travis might be able to answer that because they did a pretty big study at Virginia Lake a couple of years ago regarding that.
Yeah, so Travis Hoxton, I'm a Department of Wildlife Fisheries biologist. Prior to me taking this position, there was a study done on Virginia Lake in Reno, which has the highest density of cormorants for any of the urban fisheries. And the study showed that in any given stocking event, the cormorants, when they're present at that lake, were taking up to 95% of stocked fish. Yes, so it's pretty severe. And in that lake particular, we've been trying to get the island removed, which is the main draw for those cormorants. They nest there, and we're not having much success with that. The community really appreciates the birds. And then, so what we've done there is we've basically just stopped stocking any catchable hatchery-raised rainbows in there until about mid-October when the cormorants have started to leave for the year. So it's a drastic problem, and it's changed our stocking in that lake. So.
And what's your thoughts on our specific pond on predation loss?
That it wouldn't be that high. There's not as many cormorants that stay here, and they can only eat so many a day. And we plan them, you know, every several weeks. Every couple weeks we're putting up 500 to 800 fish in there. So I would expect those rates, the predation rates, to be lower in some of the other ponds. Like Travis mentioned, Virginia Lake is kind of a extreme example of what they can do. I don't think they're quite as effective on the other urban ponds, but they're certainly taking their fair share of our fish.
And what do they have a size constraint as to what they can't eat?
Yeah, but we're not going to be able to
stock those. Well, what is it? Is it like 3 pounds, 5 pounds?
No, I it would be. I don't know. They could take a fairly large fish, but I don't know. I couldn't tell you exactly what size. It would depend on the species, too. And trout are shaped in a way that they can go down.
They go down easy?
Yeah.
So let's get back to stocking then and usage of our pond. Chris, you mentioned the schedule. If you could go into a little bit of detail on the stocking on our pond and how often and how many fish, and then get into usage a little bit too.
Yeah, you guys have one of the most popular urban ponds, or probably the most popular urban pond that I manage. Some of the ones in Reno might get more use than here, but the one here in town is very popular, and it gets a lot of fish, partly because of the good water quality that we have year-round coming in from Clear Creek. You know, it gets that good flow. It's nice and deep, and it stays full. Even through drought years, we've seen it stay fairly high pond levels. So it gets more fish, and it gets more usage than an average urban pond. We allocate anywhere between 2,500 and 3,500 fish per year from our Mason Valley hatchery to go in there, but generally it gets almost up to double that on a good year. So we'll put 5,000 fish in there throughout the year, and it'll start as soon as it starts to warm up in the spring. You know, even as early as February, we can start stocking, and then as late as October or even into November, depending on the conditions. So it gets stocked for a long period of time, comparatively, and with a lot of fish. You know, I try to recommend to the hatchery not more than 500 at a time, because we've seen some issues at some other urban ponds where if we put 800 or 1,000 and then we have a low oxygen problem, you know, early or, you know, during mid, late summer when the temperatures are high, then I got to go out and clean up a bunch of dead fish. So I don't want to do that. So that's why we try to limit it to about 500 to 800 fish per stocking event. Sometimes they'll go heavier if the fish are smaller. Or if we have a big event coming up, you know, a kid's fishing day or something like that at these we'll stock more in just before that event because we know they're not going to last very long. So things like that. But it's generally every couple weeks during the fishing season that we're there. And it depends on the hatchery availability also, when their trucks are available, what kind of personnel they have, what kind of fish they have on station too.
And do you have any information on visitor use?
We do. I don't have that currently with me, but yeah, we keep track of that every year with our angler questionnaire data. But I don't have those numbers with me today.
Well, there's hardly a day, middle of a snowstorm, that I don't see somebody there.
Yeah, it's high, especially for this pond here in town. It's even in snowstorms, you see people out there fishing. So it's a good one. You guys should be proud of it.
Well, another question came up on what can we do about cormorants, and I don't think there's a lot, but I did a little research, and I know in the Great Lakes region, in some of the eastern states, the urban pond managers have gotten, in some cases, permission from Fish and Wildlife Service to conduct harassment, to try to keep them off of there through harassment. Is that a possibility? Or, I mean, when you have a 95% fish loss, isn't that a justification you can take? Have you tried this question to the Department of Fish and Wildlife Service, rather?
I have not, no. I haven't raised that to my supervisor or that. I know that she dealt with it over at Virginia Lake, and I'm pretty sure we got denied on those. Anytime we asked, they pretty much said no. But like I said, personally, I wasn't involved in those discussions, so I haven't been in the process of that.
So the best predator control that I'm hearing is some type of shelter for the fish to go to, and the cormorants can't go through these. Is that what I'm hearing?
It'll make it more difficult for them. They're fairly tight structured. Those are actually designed for juvenile bass cover habitat. They're pretty tight, and it would be difficult for a cormorant to get in between those to catch fish. And even if you can just slow a cormorant down, you know, when they're in pursuit, if a trout has somewhere to go and the cormorant has to make a corner or something, just make it more difficult for them to get the fish. And this is, like I said, this is new. We're trying that as of this summer. We just started putting those in. So maybe we'll get some data back on our angler questionnaires that shows us that fishing was more successful this year, and try to correlate it somehow to habitat structures that we've placed. So that's our newest idea anyway. And then pond design also is an important thing to consider when we're building these ponds. No islands, you know, we want to limit the area where cormorants and other birds of prey have to rest. You know, the closer kids can get to them and scare them away, the better.
Well, I appreciate that. And from what I'm hearing, you actually are solving some of the concerns that we have by putting your mind to giving them someplace to shelter. So thank you very much.
Yeah, sure.
And keep those trout coming.
Yeah, we will.
Thank you very much. So. And Chris, Tamar, could you pass that around for the public to see that? That's a pretty cool structure. And you can get it back, though. All right. And so, Travis, if you wouldn't mind talking about our other urban ponds, which include Hobart and Marlette. And I think there's some pictures that you can hand out to the public there, too. Why don't you tell us what's going on up at Marlette right now?
Okay, and just for clarification, I mean, it is, I guess, technically an urban because it falls within your guys' area, but yeah, for our agency, it's not an urban fishery, it's a wild fishery, and, but yeah, so anyway, we run a spawning operation up at Marlette Lake, sits up above Spooner, kind of in between Spooner and Hobart. Every year, we've been doing it at this station since the early 90s, and it's basically the broodstock for the entire state of Nevada. We pull this year, as of last Thursday, we've pulled over 1 million trout eggs from females and fertilized with the males from the lake. And those will go to our eastern region, to Elko. Some of them will end up in urban ponds down in Vegas. The majority will end up in this area. A lot going to Bailey Pond, a lot going to the Reno waters. And then some of those fish taken from there are going to be used for some studies in other waters across the state. It's occupied by rainbows, cutthroat, and brook trout, and then you've got tui chub and some other of those endemic species. But the cutthroat, we've got two strains in there right now. They're both Lahontan cutthroat. We've got the contemporary strain from Pyramid Lake, which is the strain that was prevalent early 2000s in the 90s, and then we've also started the Pilot Peaks as of about 7 years ago. The Pilot Peaks don't do as well in that alpine environment as the Pyramid contemporary strains do. Everything we're seeing is that those contemporary strain fish get a lot bigger and they're a lot healthier in the lake, and they give us more return as well in our spawning operation. We see about 5 to 10% of those Pyramid strain come back and we're able to spawn and harvest eggs, whereas the Pilot Peak strain we're only seeing about 1 to 2% return. So we're leaning more towards the Pyramid strain moving forward for our cutthroat spawning program in the future. But it's we run a volunteer operation, so myself and my two seasonal employees are up there pretty much every day once the spawn starts, which is generally beginning of June, the end of May on low water years. And then on Tuesdays and Fridays, we have spawn days, which is the days the volunteers come up. You can register through our website. And this handout that I brought, I think I brought enough for anyone who wants one. I have our volunteer page website on there, and the process is that you just get on and you register, and then you have to monitor it for projects that come up because it's agency-wide, so it's not just the fisheries programs, it's game and habitat, everything. And when you see like the Marlette program come up, you can register, and then you're basically transported in for the day since it's, you know, within the Spooner-Hobart backcountry. You're transported in, you spend the day at the lake, you help us spawn fish, you pretty much spawn the fish. I'm just up there kind of overseeing and taking the data, and, you know, have lunch up at the lake, and then you get to go home. But you get to see some awesome fish and a lot of them. Marlette's pretty unique. A lot of people don't know that it sits right up above Carson City and how great of a fishery it is. I mean, just in the last week, I've seen the biggest brook trout I've ever seen in my life in that lake, and the rainbows right now seem to be peaking. We're having a great water year, as opposed to the last couple where we were really struggling to get fish from the lake. This year, I had more fish than I knew what to do with. I thought not having enough fish was exhausting, but having too many fish is more exhausting. So, but it's awesome. Fishing, the season up there opens July 15th and runs through September 30th, and it's all catch and release, single barbless. And that's mainly the reasoning behind that is just to kind of maintain that brood stock. We don't want to affect anything. And then also, you know, the access is limited in there, and most of the people who go in there are just in there for a short time, and they're dedicated anglers who practice catch and release anyway. But then, you know, in conjunction with that, you've got Hobart just down the way where we do offer limited take, and that fishery is awesome for brookies and tiger trout and the occasional, you know, rainbow and cutbow when we stock them. All reports I've had this year have been pretty much in line with the way that the reservoir's been going the last few years. People are having 10-plus fish days, and when the weather cooperates, we seem to have had a pretty windy late spring, early summer, so people have been complaining about that, but I can't do much to fix that. And but no, you guys, you're lucky being right here. That complex of Marlette and Hobart are two of the better fisheries I've ever worked on, and recreation-wise, they're awesome. So,
question. You just said one of the largest brook trout you've ever seen. The largest one I've ever seen is about 5 pounds. Are you talking like that?
Yeah, largest one, I mean, personally ever seen in person, not a picture or something, but it was approaching 5 pounds. I don't want to say it was over because we never had it in hand, but it was large. I mean,
well, that's a great picture trophy, isn't it?
Exactly.
And I assume on July 16th, I know where to find you?
Yeah, most likely, yep. Yep. Yeah, I've been up there every day for basically the past 4 weeks, and so, you know, we're wrapping up the project now. We will be spawning cutthroat tomorrow, and that'll be the last spawn day, and then We maintain a presence up there for about a week afterwards, continuing to, when fish come into our trap, we have to spawn them, take their eggs, otherwise they'll hold them for the next, to the next year, and then any eggs they produce next year will kind of, will be worthless. We're not able to harvest them. So we stay up there and we'll strip the eggs out and just in, into the stream right there and then release the fish back to the lake. And so,
is there an appreciable, or is it really small mortality from handling these fish?
It's incredibly small. I mean, it's different from each spawn. Each lot of fish we do has a little different. It depends on the water temperature at that time, air temperature, all that. But it's less than 5% total. And, in the wild, for instance, across the lake on Marlette, there's Trelease Creek is where we spawn the fish, and then across the lake is Coley Creek, and they're able to spawn over there on their own. And this year in particular, the mortality up there has been, I would imagine or guess it's greater than 50% just because of the bears in there. They're camped on that thing, just mowing through the fish. And it's great to see. I mean, it's wildlife right there, but we're losing a lot of fish on that side of the lake just because of the bears. And in nature, when trout are spawning, they typically don't have a really high success rate or survival rate.
Oh, so the survival rate of you doing the breeding is actually higher than what it is in nature.
Oh, yeah, way, way higher. Mortality is on the adult fish, and then in raising those fish in the hatchery, we've got about an 80 to 85% survival rate and growth to catchable-sized fish, whereas in the wild, it's like 90% of fish die as, in juvenile stages, and 10% of them make it to catchable size. So.
Well, great. Thank you very much, Travis, yeah. And I appreciate what you do. And it's a really good way for anybody who wants to see Marlette to be able to ride into Marlette versus the other way to get there. So any questions, Board?
So if I may, Travis, is Travis, right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. So have you guys gotten a lot of volunteers to come up?
Oh, yeah. It's as far as my projects go, it's the most popular. When it hits the website, within a couple days, every available spawning opportunity is usually filled up. And to the point where this past year I've had a few people that I made promises to them that I would get them involved. And so once that hit the website, I was calling them at their house at 7 o'clock at night saying, hey, you need to get on the website and register so we can get you up there. And,
awesome.
And it's worked out. So, but yeah, it's desirable. So.
Travis, thank you for taking the time out, and what a great job you have.
I enjoy it. Thank you guys for having us.
And Chris, thank you. I appreciate it. And you're headquartered in Fallon, correct? All right. And Fallon, while we got you on the hot seat here, Fallon, Lahontan, I see, is hit 125, but last year it was down to 4. Did you have a survival problem last winter or not?
We didn't have any winter kill, if that's what you're asking. We did go out and do some population surveys this spring, and we found adults of multiple species. Walleye, crappie, white bass, of course carp, channel cats, white cats. We did not find any adult wipers, but they're starting to get older, and they don't reproduce naturally in there anyway, so I wasn't really expecting to find wipers. We did stock some more wipers this year, so we haven't had any major die-offs in the reservoir, but population numbers are low and recruitment has been very low for the last 3 or 4 years, because it has gotten down to 3,000 or 4,000 acre feet several years in a row. We're up to, we made it up over 130,000 acre feet this year. It's on the way back down now. As you mentioned, it's like 124, I think, this morning. So it is on the way back down. We should get flow into and out of the reservoir for most of the year this year, which has also been concerning for us in the past. They have cut off irrigation season early in the year, and there hasn't been any flow in, so it's been a stagnant pool for a couple months throughout late summer and early fall, which shouldn't happen this year. We should still get some runoff, as well as the Truckee Canal water coming in, and they're going to keep the irrigation season into September. So that constant inflow and outflow of water will also help for this year. So we haven't had any major die-offs, but numbers are low. as you can imagine. And now they're spread out because there's a lot of water, so they're hard to target also.
And I understand that the boat launch is currently open.
It is, yeah. The Sportsman's Launch on the Churchill side is open. The Silver Springs boat launch, I don't believe they opened it. I went up, we were out there a couple weeks ago when the water was almost as high as it got, and it was there was about 3 or 4 feet of water in that bay up there. We were able to boat up to it, but they still had the barricades up on the Silver Springs side. The Churchill side has been open for quite a while, and it's being used a lot. And there's plenty of water. You can boat around out there easier than you have been in several
and
years.
Last time I stopped by there on the way out to Fallon, there was a Department of Wildlife truck there doing aquatic invasive and species inspections.
Correct.
Is that a every weekend occurrence? How's that working?
They set up those stations, and they started several weeks ago, and they're there pretty much every day now throughout the summer. Between like 8 and 5, they have normal hours and weekends. I'm not sure what days they have off, but I know that they're on the weekends, so they'll have a couple days during the week that they're not there. But it's a free, you know, decontamination station that's voluntary. Anybody that comes in can get a free boat wash, basically, into or out of the lake. I use it every time I go there, so I don't have to wash my boat.
You know what would be great is if we could coordinate that with the Aquatic Invasive Species Program of Lake Tahoe, and if you were inspected and cleaned at Lahontan, it would be accepted in Tahoe. Have you ever had that discussion with the people up at Tahoe?
I have not. I don't know how they would receive that. They have their own programs up at Lake Tahoe for that stuff. I don't know how they interact with our invasive species program.
Well, currently they don't.
With our state. Well,
so if you ever have that opportunity to talk to your boss and say, could we have that discussion?
Sure. Yeah,
I'd appreciate it, and I think this board would appreciate that, and the members of the boating community would appreciate that.
Sure, I will bring that up with Karen. Karen Vargas is our staff for the Aquatic Invasive Species Program.
Thank you
very
much.
Next time we have a meeting, I'll mention it to her that she should.
Any other questions?
Miss the projects.
No.
Well,
thank you very much.
Thank you, guys. Thank you.
All right, moving on to item number nine. We have, and we lost our internet connection, so we don't have that. But there is out there the BLM draft 10-year wild horse management plan for the pine nut herd. The Carson City office is accepting comments on the draft plan until July 6th. According to the press release from BLM, this herd management population is found in the areas of Carson City, Douglas, and Lyon counties. The herd is reported to consist of 536 horses. The appropriate management level is between 119 and 179. BLM also reports that 39% of the herd is observed outside the HMA, including urban interface areas such as the Deer Run Road area, Dayton, and Fish Springs. For more information, you can refer to the BLM project website on that. And on that, here's the conclusions and recommendations from that report. And if you haven't read it, they've been managing horses there since the 1970s. And the interesting thing, if you could blow that up a little bit, hit the plus sign in the lower bottom there, bottom right. Bottom right, yep, there's a plus sign and a negative sign. Move up a little bit. Nope. There you go. Right there.
Oh, you want the font to be
Yes, there we go. Not quite that big.
Oh,
there you go. Look at that. So this is their conclusions. And yes, thank you. Monitoring indicates the health of the upland areas are primarily trending downward. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but where this is going is that if you read this information, you'll see that livestock grazing has basically been removed in all but two units in the area. There has not been livestock grazing. This area is also the historic home of a lot of sage grouse, and the amount of horses up here is exceeding their recommended appropriate management levels by approximately 3 to 4 times. So I thought I'd bring this to your attention to see if you'd want to review it, discuss it, and if you'd want to make any comments to BLM. So, gentlemen, any questions, any discussion?
Mr. Chairman, going back to 2001, when I started working on the governor's sage-grouse conservation team, and we'd go regularly through the pine nuts and looking for, you know, sage-grouse, and where their brood rearing was, where they were after the first 8 weeks, where they what they call home. And it was dramatically demonstrated about what the horses were doing to any of the wetlands that was there, the ponds, any springs. They just, the horses would take possession and exclude just about any other species that wanted to benefit from the spring. And so we put up fences, we put up chain link, we put up wires, and horse wants to get to water, it's going to get to water, we found. And there was very, you know, we kept trying, we wouldn't give up, but it was one of the, you know, when we listed in our first publication of the Nevada Sage-Grouse Conservation Plan, we pointed out that, you know, what damage was being caused to sage-grouse territory by the horses. And there were times when the Wildlife Commission threatened to sue BLM to get down to the HMA, you know, and they'd make periodic attempts to do this. We haven't seen major roundups in a long, long time. I think one of the problems is they don't know what to do with all the horses that they're rounding up. You know, when we talk about hundreds of millions of dollars costing the taxpayers to take care of the ones that are in various compounds in the northern, northwestern part of the United States, it's like we're fighting a losing battle without support from BLM wanting to really do something to bring this down to the HMA. HML, herd management level. And I thought they kind of whitewashed this in this report by saying, yeah, we know where we're at, but either they don't have the manpower or the money or the funds or whatever. And it's a problem that species like the sage-grouse are going to be paying the price until we get down to that level.
I appreciate that. And Tamar, if you wouldn't mind, would you scroll almost to the bottom of this website? Because what you were talking about, I think they do a pretty good documentation in it if you look at it. Scroll, keep going way down.
Yeah. Into the document?
Yes.
To the bottom of the document.
Yeah, now go up about... Yeah, keep going up. You can go faster. What I want you to do is go up about 10 pages when we're getting into the springs. There we go. The one I'm, well, the pictures of the springs right there. You can see what they're, scroll up a little bit. Here is a spring in 1990, and then scroll up a little bit, just a half a page, and you'll see the same sprig in 2015. And then if you'll scroll up again, You'll see another spring. There's one in 1990, and here's the same spring in 2015. Just move up right there. No, that's 1990. Roll up again. And there. There's the same spring today, and then scroll down just a half a page tomorrow, and you can see the same spring in 1990. And there you go. That's okay. You get the point. You get the point. And a lot of there you go. And it's a lot of this report, and a lot of it is that is former wetland that could be used by sage grouse, by other wildlife, and they do indicate that a lot of this damage is from horses. So that's why I brought this here, because we can certainly take an action here and make a recommendation to the State Department Wildlife Commission to support action here. And I do believe we can also send a letter to the BLM saying that we support their recommended actions. So that's why I brought it to you. Stan, do you have any comments? Because I know you know a lot about wild horses.
Well, yeah. Yes, I do own one. And I know that they eat just about anything you stick in front of them. Wood, anything. They eat like a horse, as I tell the students. The thing is, I wasn't very impressed with this. I was expecting to see some sort of a real recommendation here. It basically, after you read through the whole report, and which I did, and I read the recommendations and conclusions twice, it says we have herd management levels at one, but our herd numbers are at another, and we need to lower them. But it doesn't give you a time frame. It doesn't tell you, you know, that we want to do gathers in 2017 and remove this many, and we want to do some in 2018 and remove it, to get it down. It just says we want to get it, you know, we want to get them down. We'll use gathering and birth control to try to help. Well, the birth control is not going to do you any good until you get down to the levels, and you need to get down to that lower level, because one thing that horses are going to do is they're going to keep making other horses. And then the birth control that they use is only good for 22 months, I believe it said in there. Okay, you know, I would have liked to have seen something more substantial, because they're spending a lot of money on these horses, and we're getting more and more horses. I mean, if they're going to get it, they should put in there that at least something like within 5 years we're going to have this down to 119, and then what I would like to see in something is like then we're going to permanently sterilize, and I mean for good, not just for 22 months, 15% of the stallions, which would be easier to do that to stallions than it would be to do it to mares. Something like that, and then see what's going to happen. I mean, the horses aren't going to disappear. That's for darn sure. I've seen that. And they even talk about that if the, which they're not going to get, you know, they have no deadline as when they're going to get down to 179, that they'd bring other horses in if there's something as far as their genetic ability, like say they get some sort of a genetic problem in there or something. I don't know. It's just having worked for the Bureau of Land Management for 32 years, it's another plan that they stick on another shelf and gathers another bunch of dust. It's basically what it's going to amount to. And I've seen it done, not just with horses, but with all kinds of plans that they do. That's why I got out of planning when I was working for the Bureau of Land Management, because it doesn't go anywhere.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you have an opinion on this.
Just a little one.
Gentlemen, do you have any discussion on this issue?
I'll just say that in looking at and reading this report, I can couple a lot of what Stan said too. I don't think that there was the substance that needed to be in this report. It definitely isn't there. I don't know what the motive behind it is. To be honest with you, I don't think you'd ever see something like this come out of Department of Wildlife. I just don't think it's going to happen. I do want to point out though that, you know, as far as the impact that involves Carson City, it does specifically state that the impact is a lot less in the area that we have, here in Carson City, than it is, say, down on the backside of the Pine Nuts, on the Dayton side of the Pine Nuts as well. I think it's just a matter of time. I think Member Powell may have sent an opinion out there. I agree with him. I think it's just a matter of time before it does start happening. And, so many things that factors that drive that. We got to see that first time ever that I've seen wild horses utilizing and staying now in Washoe Lake, right? So we have a huge herd in Washoe Lake that's utilizing that. We've seen some impact issues there. I think it's just a matter of time before we see that here in Carson City, especially if we continue to have drought years and that sort of thing. So I didn't see really any good substance in this report whatsoever.
Well, I think BLM is soliciting comments to it, so I think they need to hear comments back. Member Paul, do you have anything to add?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I concur with the other two board members here, and when I read it, I see a problem, but I don't see a solution. And you can bring the problem forward, but if you don't present a solution, not much is going to happen. And the one thing that was left out of this also is my concern for Carson City is quite simply this, is that as they continue to destroy that habitat to our east in Douglas and Lyon County, that they'll move into our county. And you couple that with a known problem of feeding stations by civilians who think that the horses are beautiful and that they should be taken care of by hand feeding them. If you talk to law enforcement officers in the Highway 50 corridor east of Dayton, Highway Patrol, both Highway Patrol and Lyon County Sheriff's Office have oftentimes had to herd horses with patrol cars because the horses show up at a exact spot at exact time, the feeding stations that were set up there by civilians. There's no mention of that in this report, but bottom line is for me is that they're going to at some point in time increase their numbers here. Having lived here for over 45 years and you'd had to go a ways 20 years ago to see a wild horse east of here, unless you got into the Pine Nuts deep and found them. And now they're at the county line on a regular basis, going into the river corridor there. And in any case, I will reiterate that there's not a solution offered here other than the identification of a problem. So with that being said, I would make a motion that we notice the Department of Wildlife Commission and the Bureau of Land Management and that we accept the process of reduction numbers as indicated for what they believe to be an appropriate management level. Now, I can't recommend to them, that's a period for now. And then I would say I can't tell them how to do their job. So I don't know that it's my position, but I would say that if they've identified how many horses that the land can hold, then they need to get to that number. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Member Ball. So I think I just heard a motion that we tell BLM and we tell the state that herd should be managed at the levels that they've identified. Is that the motion I heard, Tamar? Yes. Okay.
comment, Mr. Chairman.
If we could have a second on that?
Second.
Comments?
You know, there has been times in the past where the, as I mentioned earlier, where the department has threatened to sue BLM to bring down, bring these levels with to where they're supposed to be. It never really got to that point, but like you just said, with the numbers that we're reading here, yes, they say the solution is to bring the herd level down. They haven't said how or when they're going to do it. So I think we need to prey on the Wildlife Commission to take action directed towards the BLM to come up with a plan that has the numbers and the dates and when how they're going to do it. I mean, talking about it, as Member Powell said, doesn't get the job done. And when you see firsthand, I mean, we've seen the pictures very dramatically showing the before and after, the effects of the wild horses. And they're like any animal. They're going to want to survive, and they'll do whatever it takes to survive at the expense of other species. And that's what's been happening. So I think this board needs to start, as you're indicated, Mr. Chairman, to bring notice to the Department of Wildlife and to the BLM of what our intent, you know, we're disappointed with their suggestions or plan because it's, there's nothing finite in it. It just talks in hyperbole about what needs to be done, but doesn't show how they're going to do it and when they're going to do it.
And I think the first step with BLM is that they need to hear that they have support to have these horses at the appropriate management level populations. And I think that's the signal that that motion would make. I think if we act on that motion, and then if you want another motion that says, and we want it done within, or we could amend it, that we would like that done within a reasonable time frame, and you can suggest what that reasonable time frame is on an amendment if that's what your discussion is.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I think that would be the right approach to take, is say, you know, we know we can't, we realize it can't be done overnight, but they've had, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, when I started in 2001 and here we are in 2016, and we're still dealing with the same problem.
So would you like, well, would you like to amend the, suggest an amendment to the motion? The motion right now is that we would like to send a message to the State Wildlife Commission and to the BLM to get to these appropriate numbers.
Yeah, it would be nice to amend the motion with a, you know, with a, let's say that within the next 3 to 5 years to be at this level. I mean, we've seen they haven't been able to get to it in 16 years. And to give them, say they're going to do it in a short period of time, we know that will not happen because they don't have the funding and stuff like that. But if we give them 3 to 5 years to be at this level, maybe that's the start.
So are you making a motion to amend this motion to add?
Mr. Chairman, you know, if I may, I'm starting to get a little bit lost here with
yeah,
the motions
thank
that are
you.
Out there.
Help
so, you know, because we had a first, we had a motion, then we had a second, and then we were having discussion right now with the possibility of an amendment. I think just for procedural clarity, if we're not going to take a vote on the first amendment as proposed, I'm sorry, the first, see, I'm confusing myself, the first motion as submitted, let's withdraw that first motion. And let's just have a clear motion. You can, but just I think everything's it's probably procedurally more crisp to withdraw the first motion.
I think I'm hearing though that it's a very that there's support on, let me ask, is there support that we send the message that we support these numbers?
Yes.
Yes. So that was the motion. So the second part of the motion is, and that we would like to have this done within 3 to 5 years. Is that what I'm hearing the amendment would be?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Yes, Mr. Chairman.
So I think that we could do this as an amendment, that okay. We accept the current motion and that we just add to it that it be done within 3 to 5 years.
As long as it's clear on the record, that's fine.
Okay. Tamar, can you make that clear? Okay. So are you making that amendment motion?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
So no, it has to be from Mr. Paul. Mr. Paul, can you amend it to be that?
I would move that, recommend my own motion to include a timetable in there with some definitive action between 1 and 4 years.
And I would second that, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All right. Is that okay then, Tamar?
Yeah.
Okay. You got it? Dan? We're good? Okay. All right, so we have a motion and a second on it. I would like to open this up to the public since we do have a motion on the table. So members of the public, any concerns, thoughts, ideas on wild horses? Yes, sir. State your name for the record, please.
Good afternoon. Mel Belding, lifetime resident. Conservationist. I'd like to invite you guys up to Winnemucca Ranch this weekend. We've been fencing off 3 springs, Upper and Lower Scott and Mud Springs. What we dealt with a couple of years ago was the same thing that you're seeing here in your neck of the woods. It was dirt. Last year we had some pretty good rains. We had very good brush growth. The grasses were a little lacking, but we did have some really good leader growth. On the 3 projects, we've fenced in over 20 acres. We're going to fence the last one, Mud Springs, this week. We use a wildlife-friendly fence. So wildlife can access and egress this fence very easy. It's a 48-inch rail and a 28-inch rail. Antelope, bighorn, sheep usually go beneath it. Deer go over the top of it. Young deer stay. But this is something that's working. We did this 5 years ago in the Desitoyas in Hay Press. We literally have hundreds of acres that we want to attack in the Desitoyas. It's working. Sage grouse numbers, where I count, I've been counting Lex now for over 20 years, and this year we are double what we were last year. And I can honestly say that because of projects like this, it certainly helps. One thing we do, Mr. Yannick, we provide water to livestock and feral horses on the outside of the exclosure. In Upper Scott, we had 4 springs that we tied together. And when I checked it just Friday with the biologist, we had about 7 gallons a minute going into 2,000-gallon troughs, where last year we had about 0.5 gallon going into those. So just this 1 year of snow has brought us back. I talk a little bit about leader growth on brush, but this year we see our native grasses really coming back and out competing the purple mustard and the yellow mustard. My suggestion, I don't know where these springs are at. I have no idea if they're private or if they're owned by the BLM, if the water's owned privately, or if someone has a 40-acre parcel around it. That's very common in Nevada. They'll have a 40-acre parcel. When this happens, it's a lot easier for us to do our work when we do not have to go through the BLM or the forestry, any agency. When we can deal with a landowner, they're very cooperative. Any old cowboy just loves to have that nice new trough out there and the new piping to it and a new spring box put in his spring. I would suggest that also on the AMLs that, you know, I'm involved with them all the time throughout the state, EAs, EISs. It's really discouraging when you have to deal with these guys. But if this is privately owned, you're one step up. You can step that off. You're not going to keep anything from the feral horses, but you know we can put a trough on the outside of that. Pretty simple, and that's a solution. This is a solution. We're going to save our meadows and our springs. And believe me, I know exactly how you feel. I lived here my entire life, and I've seen this country just beat to death because of this. And we really do have to find a solution. And the biggest solution would be, of course, for the BLM and the U.S. Forest Service to follow the 1971 Wild Horse and Burro Act to the letter. And we need to euthanize those animals over. All I got. Thanks.
Thank you. Any questions?
Yes, sir. If you don't mind, just answer. Who do you represent? When you said we, you know, you're going in.
I was
like a group of you that are just.
I was on the
it,
board. Yes, I was on the board of directors of Nevada Bighorns Unlimited for years.
Okay.
Mr. Yannick knows me pretty well. I've received about every award there is to receive doing this stuff, and right now, the three projects we're doing, I was actually was asked by the rancher, the landowner, to come in and talk and.
So you personally, or?
Yes.
So real quick, if I could just, so we make the best use of our time. Are you still with Nevada Bighorns? Is that who's sponsoring the project? Or is it you and a bunch of guys?
This particular project was paid for by Nevada Department of Wildlife.
Perfect. And we're talking about the Winnemucca Ranch project, correct?
Mm-hmm. The Desitoyas. Gil knows as well as I do. Mr. Yannick knows as well as I do. There's monies available out there, uh-huh. And what you want to do is work with your local, with Carl, you want to get with your biologist and say, look, there's all kinds of money in the Upland Game Program, Upland Bird Program, and that's what that money should be spent for. And what you're going to do is, this is expensive. I mean, it's not at all cheap, but it's the very best way to combat the problems that you're having around these springs and meadows. They're just too vital. They're too important to us and to the wildlife.
Yeah, so one more question, if I can. It sounds like you've kind of monitored some of the impact that these enclosures have had on
different
springs and whatnot. Have you seen anything that has, you know, I mean, you have put a structure around a water hole, but you provide water for wild horses and burros on the outside of the water hole, right?
Mm-hmm.
Has there been any impact to the horses or burros? I mean, is that enough water for them to sustain their life? Or is, I guess that was, you know, I think it's that I'm unclear on.
I plan on, when I go in and look at these projects, I ask the cowboy, how many cows do you have here?
No, I'm just talking about in your experience.
So what we do, in my experience, yes, but I take my knowledge of what I've done my entire life and apply it to this. So we had two 750-gallon troughs. We had 120 head of cows, okay? So we had some calves also. But at no time were those cattle deprived of water, and the feral horses on the Winnemucca Range at any time with just over 2 gallons a minute going into the trough. So, yes, it can be figured. A bighorn sheep will drink a gallon and a half of water a day when it drinks. A horse will drink 15. So you can see how much water you really have to store to support these animals. It's not so much the graze that we look at. It's the amount of water that a horse has to have to survive. And it's very critical to them.
I appreciate that. And if I can interject here, we're starting to get apples and oranges. So one of the things that we're talking here is there is a population target that BLM has identified. And what Mr. Belding was just talking about is how to water horses outside of an enclosure, which is slightly different than, but related to the population. You'll agree with that. What's on the table right now, Mr. Belding, is the population. And what we're doing is we're asking BLM to bring the population down to where they recommend it to be. It, right now, it's 4 to 5 times higher than what they recommend. So you see what we're saying is, please bring the population down to your own target number. And that's what our motion is about. And you're talking about how to control it, how to control the springs, which is a good thing, too. So
you control the water, you control the animal.
I understand.
You can do it the opposite way also.
Right.
So but, yeah, I agree with you. We need to bring all of them down. That there's not an AML, there's not a horse management area in the state that is not less than 300% over.
Right.
Not so one.
One quick question for you then is, do you support our motion that we ask BLM and the department to bring that down to the recommended population levels?
That I've seen through the past, if it was me doing it, I would recommend that the Board of Wildlife Commissioners write that letter. I would ask you guys to ask them to write that letter. We just wrote one about 3 years ago, if you remember, Mr. Yannick. And was it successful? No. But I urge all of you, anyone in this room, this is a problem. And you have to address this on your own also, individually. And it takes attending meetings just like this one right here to talk to the BLM. And they set it up in a lot different format. They put little kiosks all around the room, and you will talk to an individual employee of the BLM. So you really don't come up in front like I'm doing to you, but it's set up in a pretty nonchalant way to where you really can't get your voice to the right guy. But writing a letter on your own with your own words, I found is the best way to communicate with most of these people. But just remember, for every one of us, there's about 3 on the other side trying to support the feral horse. So, but yes, I think it's good, but I would ask the state commission to write that letter for you.
I think that's part of our motion, is to ask that. Thank you very much.
State my name. Okay.
So any other public comments regarding this motion? Mr. Voltz.
Yes, for the record, Fred Voltz. We could round up and kill human beings if we decided that cities such as Reno, Carson City, even Las Vegas, had too many people and there weren't the water resources to support it. I don't see anybody suggesting such a policy proposal. And similarly, it's not appropriate for the wild horses. What BLM has done is to imprison them, not gather them, and basically treat them in a very substandard way with no shelter, no adequate shade of any type, no protection from the elements, and basically is doing them a huge disservice until they just decide to sell them off to some slaughterhouse and kill them. So I think your motion is very wrong-headed. You really need to be looking at the core issue, which is not necessarily the wild horses, but they are outnumbered probably by 5 or 6 times by the land that the BLM is leasing at a very inexpensive rate to the ranchers in this state. And the cattle that they run not only deplete the water resources from the alfalfa they have to grow to support the cattle, but also trample the landscape and basically destroy the habitat, not just for the sage grass, for other animals. So you could be recommending to BLM that they sever or reduce or cancel some of those leases for the cattle ranchers because they're doing much more damage than any wild horse population in the state. Thank you.
Any other public comment? Mr. Davis.
Just for the record, my name is Jim Davis. I'm just here on my own behalf. And what Mr. Voltz is saying, they're already doing that. The ranchers have decrease their herds by up to 40% in some cases. And if the resource is there, they're allowed to raise that resource. But when the resource is not there in the drought years, when there is no water, those ranchers are required to reduce their herd. The BLM points to them and says, you have to reduce your herd by 40%. And they are mandated to do that. With the wild horses, they are not mandated. They just let them run, and there is no control on the wild horses. We can't manage this land for one species. There's not just horses. There's deer, there's elk, there's antelope, there's bighorn sheep. Everybody knows that. The land has to be managed for everything and not just for the wild horses. And the wild, something has to be done. Every year there's a deer hunt to reduce the herds. Every year you're reducing the elk herds, the deer herds, the antelope herds. The only herds that are growing are the horse herds. The only herds that are unmanaged are the horse herds. And it's totally irresponsible to let, in a lot of these units, there are no cattle. And the land is still being decimated. It's gone. It's history. And if that land goes to the point that it can't come back, nothing lives on it. And that's my point. So the horses have to be managed along with every other species. Thank you.
Thank you. There's a question.
Mr. Davis. So you've heard the motion that we have, that the board has made here. Do you support that? Or?
I do support that.
Thank you very much. Any other public comment? Bring it back to the board here for an action on the motion. So all those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Moving on to item number 10. This is our consent agenda items. There are numerous regulations that are being heard this Friday and Saturday. A lot of them are the second reading of several that we've already looked at. We have them on our consent calendar as items 9A through 9G. They are considered routine and may be acted upon by the board with one action and without extensive hearing. Although a member of the advisory board may request an item to be pulled for separate discussion and action, the advisory board chair retains discretion in deciding whether or not to pull it from the consent calendar. There will be no public comment unless an item is pulled for separate discussion and action. Gentlemen, there are several items up for discussion. Do you care to pull any of them and discuss them further?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
What item on the agenda was the prior to this? The wild horse.
That was item 9. Prior to this was item 9.
Okay, and you're...
And that was the wild horse item. And we are now on item number 10, which is the consent calendar.
Oh, I must have a different agenda. Thank you.
Are you okay? Oh, you down long road? Well. Well, if there are none from the other board members, I would like to pull item number 10B. No, I'm sorry, 10A, which is upland game and fur bearer seasons and bag limits for further discussion. So, gentlemen, any of the others? If not, I would entertain a motion that we support and let the commission know that we support all of the other items, which would be 10B through 10F, 10G rather. I would entertain such a motion.
I make a motion that we support items, all the items on the consent items with the exception of 10A to be pulled for further discussion.
Second.
Thank you. Any further discussion on that motion? If not, I'd like to call for the motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Item 10A, the upland game and fur bearer seasons, there are two parts to that. The upland game, I don't have any issues with any of the tag limits that are being proposed. It's just the issue of fur bearer seasons, especially the trapping regulations for, I believe, bobcat. This year is being proposed at a lower level than previous years. And I'm not quite certain why that is occurring. I did receive, and I'll give you a disclaimer right now, that I received a letter from Joel Blakesley, an email indicating that he is suggesting that we have a higher than normal or we have a good recruitment this year on bobcats, and that it supports a 120-day season instead of the 94-day season that's being proposed. And so based upon the information that he sent me, I wanted to at least have a discussion on that and see what the rest of you think on that.
So if I may, Mr. Chair, Joel Blakely, can you kind of fill me in who is that and what is he about?
He represents the trapping industry, and he's a lobbyist for the Nevada Trappers Association.
And did he conduct data or surveys? Where did he get his data?
He got his data from the Department of Wildlife regarding recruitment. And I think there's a member of the audience tonight that can maybe add a little bit more to that. So I think somebody here has some specific Perfect. Information. Could you come up forward, please? So are you familiar with what I'm talking
yes,
about?
Yes, for the record, Bob Ritter.
So if you could,
speaking for myself, every bobcat that's harvested is audited by the department, and they take a look at it, and they check it for age and sex, and so they're have very specific data from each year's harvest on the composition of the population, whether it's they have new recruitment in, there's a lot of recruitment in, or if it's a lower recruitment year for kittens coming in, they can tell from the jaws. Every jaw has to be turned in from every legally harvested bobcat, and so they get an excellent review. So in past years, when there are less than 30 kittens per 100 animals, then they will recommend that we have a reduced season. And so that happened 5 or 6 years ago, and that season was reduced. And usually they do it 2 years on and then 2 years off. So last year, the previous years was at 66, I believe. Last year's data shows 94 kittens per 100, and which is one of the most phenomenal years out there. It's really high and off the charts. So those are some of the specific numbers that the department has given us. In the trapping report, it also shows that there is a reduced number of trappers and trap days out there. Fur prices are down. The Russians buy a lot of the furs and drive the fur market a lot. Their economy is down, so fur prices are down. So there are less people in the field trying to bobcat hunt. And so we've got conditions where there are less trappers out there, there's less trapper days out there, there's higher recruitment. And then again, for myself, the reason that we come here and do this every year and the legislature's every other year is we can take a look at every year the different rainfalls, the different habitat conditions and everything like that. So, I mean, for myself, I see the additional rabbits. I mean, how many ground squirrels did you see yesterday? I mean, it's crazy. They're everywhere. So normally this would be a 120-day season. It should be going back to this somebody's trying something that seems rather random. It's not based on the data, which is 94 per 100, which is hard fact based on actual animal counts and biologists looking at the harvest. And then, again, what we all saw for this kind of a winter and this type of a moisture event that we've got. So it should go back. Normally it would be going back. So I would ask that you make a motion to recommend to the commission a 120-day season for bobcats and gray fox. The one other item that's a little different that I heard the other day is trappers in the east need that November time because they get snowed out. So, I mean, they can't go the whole season. And the folks out west here, the chucker season ends and they want to get February in so they can go ahead and trap without any chucker dogs or any conflicts there. So nobody goes the whole season, but there isn't any reason why we shouldn't have the full 120 days.
Thank you. So that's the issue that I heard, and I wanted to bring that to the board so that we could at least discuss and consider 120 versus a 94-day season.
So if I may, Mr. Chair, so is there any reason that we know of that the commission has not made the recommendation to increase this? I mean, it sounds like to me if what this gentleman is saying is accurate, that's kind of a no-brainer. Did we get any indication on why they did not recommend to increase it? Well, I mean, I didn't see anything in the support materials. So.
In the support materials that I got, I couldn't find anything justifying why they were considering a 94-day season. I think Mr. Belding has an idea as to why they do that. Mr. Belding, do you have an idea why they're recommending 94 days?
Yes, I do. For the record, Mel Belding. Previously, since 1981, we've been collecting this data on cat jaws. And a good mean to start is the 66 number that Mr. Bruner brought up. That happened last year. This year, we had 94 kittens per 100 bobcat females, and we had 149 toms per 100 females. There's three things that drive this: kitten production, tom over female, mature female, and trap nights. So how many guys are in the field? What Russell has done, the predator biologist, this is the first time he's used the three-year data. This is it just in the draft form now. Any time in the past, we've always gone with 2 years data and to drive the seasons back and forth. In the past 20 years, we've had 16 120-day seasons and four that were reduced. So Russell is wanting to go, it's in draft form, I want to add. So what we feel is that we need to have input on the three-year season instead of the two, which, as you know, we set seasons for 2 years is the way we do it now. Now, that there's a present guy here from Arizona that wants to go three, but most sportsmen feel that we want to stay with the two. But we'd like to have more input, and my recommendation would also be to set a 120-day season instead of what they're calling the standard season now of 94.
Great, thank you. Did that answer your question?
Yeah.
So I don't understand trapping. I'm not a trapper, and so I just hear that the information is supporting a longer period, and I just wanted to see if this board was interested in hearing this. And then seeing if there's any interest in taking action.
Mr. Chairman, from what we've heard from Mr. Bruner and Mr. Belding, and also being supported, you know, by the head of the Trapper Association here in the state, recommending going to 120 days seems a pretty logical recommendation to make to the Department of Wildlife. And being that, I'd like to make that into a form of a motion, if I might.
You may. Is that a motion you just made?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. If there is a motion, yes. We will certainly have more public comment.
Well, I mean, you just had two, but you didn't finish the public comment.
Okay, all right. I have a motion at the board level, and I'll finish that motion, and then I'll take more public comment.
Fine. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So there's a motion to support 120-day trapping season.
Second.
Thank you. Any further public comment?
Yes, for the record, Fred Boltz. Hunter convenience, opportunity, and success should not be the driving factors behind supposedly management of wildlife policy. The actual statistics that I've seen from Mr. Woolstein-Hume is that for the last 8 years, the populations of bobcats have been going down consistently. So you can analogize it to the same situation as a drought, where you might have one good year of rain. That doesn't mean that you squander water any more than you set up for a longer season to kill more bobcats, because there's no guarantee that next year will not be a bad year. So you have to look at that historical data and decide what you will or won't do with wildlife. So to have a longer season and to kill more is completely irresponsible from a scientific standpoint, and there is indeed no science to support such a recommendation. To have the trappers propose such a thing because they want to kill more and they want to sell more, that's not managing wildlife. That is just catering to a small interest group. And I will remind you, we only have about 1,100 licensed trappers in this state of 2.9 million. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other public comment? Anybody have any information? One question was that it was just stated that the bobcat numbers are decreasing. I don't have any information regarding that. Does anybody else have any information regarding populations? Yes.
I don't have any information regarding population, but I don't know how responsible it is for us to make a motion on information, or I mean take action on information that, you know, we're getting from, that's, we can't validate, you know what I mean? I don't know, I mean, how are we validating? I mean, we have one person with public comment that just said that he shows that the numbers go down. We had two gentlemen that said that the brood numbers were up, right? I'm a little confused. You know, what position should we take as a board that would support?
Thank you. Whatever that static was.
Yeah. Whatever. I guess. How do we support data that we can't confirm? You know what I mean? On both sides of the fence. You know what I mean?
I hear you. And I gotta tell you that personally, I think I agree with you. I do agree with you, and that is, I don't see the numbers from Mr. Woolstein-Hume in front of me. I don't see where they were provided or not provided. And I do appreciate the Trapping Association people coming here and explaining the situation. But without me being able to ask Mr. Woolstein-Hume direct questions, I don't feel comfortable voting on this motion either.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Paul.
And I understand both your points. And I would suggest that if we pass a motion and send it to the Wildlife Commission for consideration, we're basically raising our hands and asking for some dialogue and discussion. If you had someone call you and suggest that there's an issue, and yeah, he represents trappers, the voice of everyone needs to be heard. So the way I view it is all we're doing is raising our hand and saying, could you explain to us why this is happening? We are not the arbiter anyway. We're the suggester. Thank you.
So if I may, real quick, I agree with that 100%. If we can somehow go to the commission and say to them, listen, we had kind of two thoughts of thinking here, you know, come to our meeting and make recommendations, you know, how are we validating this? I think it's worth looking into and seeing how they're validating the data that they have coming forward to recommend a 94-day season versus 120-day season, because I agree 100%. If what those two gentlemen right there are saying is valid, then I would absolutely support a 120-day season without a doubt. But I don't feel comfortable making that determination now, saying, hey, we support a 120-day season when we haven't validated the data that's come forward there. But if it's a matter of going to the commission and saying, hey, we think you guys need to look into this and help us, you know, help us understand that, you know, how you're coming up with this 94-day season and why it's recommended, then I'm all for that.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Mr. Belding came up earlier and was quoting some numbers about what was the results taken by counting the number of jaws taken by the trappers. And maybe he can explain that further so we understand where that data came from.
Again, Mel Belding, for the record. The state is set up in a way to collect bobcats, just like bobcat jaws, just like deer, antelope, elk, bighorn, sheep are managed. Everything's in a unit managed. As far as numbers, the number that we received from Russell Wilson, whom was 27,000 for a population of bobcats.
If I may, Mr. Belding, Russell
Wilson, whom
he is the biologist, right? Is it my getting
He's the
that
predator correct? Biologist, correct?
Okay, perfect.
And I believe what, and Mr. Volz can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe what he's talking about for the past 8 years is a compilation of numbers that a man by the name of Don Moldy put together. And Dr. Moldy has taken a study that was on captured bobcats, and he uses a 1-to-1 ratio. So when you use a 1-to-1, which means 100 kittens per 100 females, and this was done one time in a study, but the study was done on captured bobcats. So he takes the numbers and a means at the 30% to where he says you should have one kitten per one female bobcat breeding age. And that's where he comes to the conclusion that the past 8 years that the bobcat population is actually dropping, when it absolutely is not. We've been doing this for 40 years, the Department of Wildlife has. The state of Nevada has the very best bobcat data in the world. There is no other fish and wildlife agency that does what the Department of Wildlife does here in Nevada with bobcats. And when you use a 1-to-1 ratio, you might be able to show that a bobcat population is coming down. But realistically, think about a deer. If we're at 33, 34 fawns per 100 does, we have a growing population. We're talking a bobcat population of kittens of twice of what we're trying to manage our big game herds for. So you might want to take a look on that. But it is 66 per 100 is the number we're looking for. And we exceed that.
I appreciate that. And my problem is similar to these gentlemen's problems, and that is that right now you were interpreting Dr. Moldy, and Mr. Volz is giving me information that what I'm hearing is you're not Dr. Moldy. So
no, sir, but I can bring up his data.
No, I understand.
I can show you his data and how he derived that off of 1-to-1.
But the problem is, and it's personal, is that I don't have a representative here from the Department of Wildlife to be able to present this to and ask them questions, and I'm not intelligent enough on this to be able to have your information in my head. So I'm getting it from you. So And I know you and I respect you a lot, but my problem is that I don't have Mr. Wolsenhume here to ask these questions. That's just me personally.
Do you have any support material?
I was just going through it one more time, and what we have.
I looked at it pretty well, the support materials that was given for the commission meeting. They don't present any data to support the 194-day season. So the 94-day season, right? So
because it's in draft form.
Right.
This is in draft form to go to the 3-year data instead of doing it on the 2-year data that we've done for the past 40 years.
So, you know, because this is in a draft form, it's going to come back to us again, and then we'll have the information.
They will decide the season in Elko.
And they will. Okay.
Yes, they will.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank
Let
you,
me bring
Mr.
this
Miller.
Back to the board. I'd like to discuss the motion. Do you see what my dilemma is?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, but I think there may be a solution. At the meeting on Friday and Saturday, it's relatively easy to bring up this issue that is confronting our board and put the department on the spot and say, listen, you recommended this. We've had people come to our meeting who are saying the numbers justify 120 days rather than 94. There was no data provided to our board to substantiate one or the other. While the commission is meeting, can you please tell us what is the true numbers so that can we justify 120 or 94? How did you come up with those numbers? Based on what? Because you didn't give it to us.
I appreciate that. And you are going to that particular board meeting, and so is Mr. Beamer. You will both be there, and you will be able to ask those questions. And so we have a motion on here that the motion is that we support a 120-day season.
Great.
And it's been seconded. And at this particular time, I can't support that motion carte blanche. But I can certainly send the two of you to the commission meeting, and I would be comfortable sending you to that commission meeting, asking them how they came up with those numbers, and could those numbers support a 120-day season? And if it can support a 120-day season, our board supports that. But that's not the motion. The motion is right now, that we recommend a 120-day season. That's what the motion is. So it would either have to be amended that we support a 120-day season if the numbers support it. But you're going to have to find that out there if you amend it that way.
Well, I think it's easy for either Rob or myself to ask that question when this issue comes up and say, we've had this long, long discussion, and we don't have the data to base a final vote on.
So if you amended your motion to say that our board supports a 120-day season,
if the
department at this meeting says that the numbers are justifiable.
That is correct.
So would you like to amend your motion to that?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to amend my motion to modify it such that if the department at the meeting in Elko can provide the data that supports a 120-day season, that's what our motion would be.
Okay. And who seconded this?
I did.
You did. Would you?
I would second that.
Thank you. Discussion on that.
The only discussion I have is that I don't think you're going to be the only person asking that question up there.
I hope not. I
it
I mean,
may be easier
how do
than
we make
we
a
think.
Decision like that, you know? I just hope that everybody, I hope the public realizes that, you know, we're taking a responsible, I think we're taking a responsible action here. You know what I mean? It's, I can't make it, I can't endorse something or, you know, endorse a recommendation that I don't have I can't validate the data, right? So, I mean, how we have it right now, I 100% support that.
Okay. I think we've had enough public comment on this issue. Do you agree with that? Okay. I'd like to bring it back for call a motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Thank you very much. Whew. That takes care of item number 10. Item number 11. Other items on the Wildlife Commission that have not been discussed previously under the regulatory can be discussed. Occasionally, one or more advisory board members may wish to discuss any of these other items. Gentlemen, any other items on the wildlife agenda you want to discuss and take possible comments to the commission? Going once, going twice. Okay, seeing none. Item number 11 is closed. Item number 12. Discussion regarding NDAO's new paperless policy. We received a letter from Tony Wassley, and it states that in accordance with the strategic planning framework of the governor's office, the Nevada Department of Wildlife is striving to become more efficient and responsive in going paperless for commission agendas and support materials. The potential cost savings to sportsmen's revenue was evaluated and will be substantial. This particular packet, I read the first half of it word for word. The second half, under the duck stamp program, I skimmed that. And that is approximately 107 pages. And so I see their point. I did talk to them. I gave them a call, and I asked them, how much did it cost you last year to send out this to all of the CAB members who get that? And it's somewhere in the neighborhood of $2,500 just in material. And then I said, well, how much time do you and the two of you put into this? And that added probably another $2,500. So all of this is $5,000. Now, how many of you are going to take the duck stamp program home and frame it and put it on your shelf? Not me. So I am certainly willing to go paperless. Now, you do not have to go paperless. The staff will continue mailing this if you let them know you still have to have this, the paper copy. That came in the packet. The duck stamp program did? Came in my packet.
You're special.
I'm special. Look at that.
It was in mine?
Yeah, it was in his, too.
Not mine.
Huh. Right there. What's that?
Oh. That's the blue ribbon.
You didn't get one?
Pages.
Well, I'm special. I got the duck stamp report. I'll be glad to give it to you. Okay. Anyway, I'm certainly willing to try to go paperless.
Mr. Chairman, at the last meeting, you came up with a suggestion of how we were going to do this, about having it available if anybody wanted to see it, that we could project it so that we wouldn't have to print out.
Right. And I asked the department to send us a copy of the entire packet that we could put on a screen and project on while we're discussing.
To download and
project it. And so I would like to do that in the future, but I'm just letting you know, each one of you has the option of continuing to get this paper or not. Okay. All right. So I just wanted to have a discussion on this, and I'm going to let them, I'm going to let mine expire, and I'm not going to get a hard copy anymore, and I encourage you all to not get a hard copy anymore and use a computer. But if you still want to have a paper copy, you can certainly do that. I don't think we need a motion on this. It was just a discussion on their paperless policy, and we'll try to project those up on the screen so the public can see them too. Any other comments on
just,
that?
Just so everyone understands, Mr. Chair, it's not just the Department of Wildlife. It's all state agencies that are attempting to do that as well. So my agency, we're on the same page. So, yeah.
Okay. I appreciate that. All right. Yes.
One more comment. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine.
The thing that I think is important for the members to have and is to know what's on the agenda, you know, not the all the backup comments that refer to line, you know, specific item number in the agenda. That's where the bulk of that printing is support information. Now, I think it's still important for everybody to either get an agenda or print out the agenda, so when we come here, you know, we'll get it after the fact, because we get this just before our meeting, essentially. And when this comes out, the draft form is what we start looking at it, and then there's a final version that doesn't change often that much. And we could do something, because it's usually 5 or 6 pages, the actual agenda of what will take place at the meeting. And I think that's what concerns most of us. And the support material, if anybody wants to refer to something to show other members or the public, members of the public, we could project that on this wall or the screen if anybody cares to.
And I agree with you, Mr. Yannick. And this is this letter is saying that the packet of support material they would like to not send out, but we'll still be getting the agenda.
Oh, okay.
I did ask them if they could take this packet and put it into a PDF and send it to us so that we have it in a packet form rather than having to go and hunt and peck each one of them. I think you have a really good point, though, because of that last discussion we just had about the fur-bearing seasons on bobcats. In the support material, there was nothing in here on population and how they got to that recommendation, because it's in a draft form. And so we didn't have that, but we should have that draft form information, so we wouldn't have been up here fumbling over, you know, should it be 94 or 120? So that's more important in the background packet information than me having 2 inches or an inch of paper here. So, okay. Any other discussion on this? Appreciate it. Item number 13, discussion regarding the advisory board commitments to this Friday and Saturday, the Wildlife Commission meeting in Elko. It's my understanding that Mr. Yannick and Mr. Beamer are going to be both going.
Be there Thursday, Friday, and Saturday.
Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, okay.
And I'll just be there Thursday and Friday.
Okay, and I believe there's something on Operation Game Thief going on.
Yeah, that's really the reason the main reason I'm going is workers on the early award for Operation Game Thief. So I also have work I have to do there, so it's kind of a twofold mission for me. The board's not paying for me to go, just for the record.
Oh, great. Thank you very much. And I assume the board is paying for you to go there.
Unfortunately, yes.
Yeah. Okay. I hope so. I appreciate that. All right. Item number 14, our next Wildlife Advisory Board meeting will be scheduled prior to the August 12th and 13th. Would like to talk to you about the scheduling. We currently have it, and it always has been the Monday before. And I've heard some people have some conflicts with the Monday before. And I'm not pointing at anybody, and I don't have a problem with that. I just want to discuss it. and see what the issue is and if we need to adjust at all. So does anybody have problems with the Monday at 4 o'clock? Yes, Mr. Yannick.
Occasionally. Yeah, I'm on the Board of Trustees and do a number of different committees for the hospital, and it just always seems that the Monday that we have our Wildlife Advisory Board meeting, I have a quality meeting where we go over some very sensitive issues and some have to take some action regarding quality at the hospital. So the meeting starts at 2:30 and goes till 4. I haven't been able to stay at the meetings because I missed it. I came in late one time and then I missed it totally another, and it became a problem. So I would, you brought up a couple of choices. One, move the day of our meeting, because the other issue was if we started at 4:30, then like today, it would be 6:45 rather than 6:15. So I think the easiest thing for most people, since they've kind of scheduled themselves the Monday before the commission meeting is our meeting, and it's easy to remember when that's going to happen because the schedule is published 2 years in advance. If we could get 30 minutes, or maybe if it's over by 4, took me 18 minutes to get here today from the hospital. So if we could go for 4:15, I'd try that. Or 4:30 would be ideal, but, I'll compromise for half.
Okay, I appreciate that. Now, first off, it's tentatively scheduled for Monday, August 8th. Do you know if you have a hospital meeting on August 8th, or is it every Monday?
It's always this is the third Monday of the month.
Your hospital meetings are the third Monday of the month.
Usually it comes out the third Monday. I have the schedule for that quality meeting, and I'll look at its schedule.
So you don't know it right now.
But this
is actually the second Monday of the month. The August 8th is.
Oh, the next one.
Yes.
The next one, yes. Right. Well, Mr. Chairman, I'll take it as my responsibility to look at the schedule for all the following quality meetings and see if any of them would conflict
with this. Okay.
And then we can talk at the next meeting.
Okay, so 4 o'clock on August 8th is
That's
our
correct.
Next meeting. Okay,
yes.
All right, enough discussion on that.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Sorry. There is a Visitors Bureau meeting in this room on August 8th. just FYI, schedule someplace
else. So we may be in the brick building.
We may be somewhere else.
Oh, okay.
Check with the Visitors Bureau to see if they will really have a meeting or not.
Well, between now and August 8th, we'll figure out where we'll be, and we'll let you know. All right, item number 15, close 14, go to 15. Future agenda items. This was a quite full agenda. Gentlemen, you asked for last time a discussion on the Bailey Pond, and then we had a discussion from our legal representative, and then we had another discussion. There was a lot. And so with that said, I'll entertain future agenda items, and I'll just let you know that I may be practicing discretion. So are there any future agenda items you'd like to bring up? Mr. Paul.
One of those discussions we had was a report from Parks on what's happening with the shooting range there, the status of the grant they applied for. So with Roger and Scott gone, I don't know who's filling the void there, but somebody has to know what's going on there. So we probably need to look into that and see where, at least get some informational on the status of the grant and where they're going next. Thanks.
And I think that would be Vern Krall who would be able to do that. Could you tomorrow put out an email to Vern and ask him if he could come for a 5-minute presentation?
I'll check with Jennifer. She's the Roger replacement. Jennifer?
Who is?
Jennifer Budge.
Okay. All right. If you could send out
to
that email,
and I'll copy.
I'd appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Paul. Any other agenda items? No. Thank you. Okay, closing item 15. Item 16, public comment. The public is invited at this time to comment on and discuss any matter that is relevant to or within the authority of the Carson City Advisory Board to Manage Wildlife, including any matter that is not specifically included on the agenda as an action item. No action may be taken on a matter raised under this item of the agenda. Yes, sir.
Again, Mel Belding. I just want to say I've attended meetings throughout this state on county advisory boards, and I have to say that this is the most well-run meeting place I've ever been to. And I've been attending wildlife meetings since 1975, guys, and this is by far one of the best I've ever seen. I like your format, and I want to commend you for a great job. Thank you.
And I thought we were losing it up here tonight. Thank you. Any other public comment? I do have one public comment myself. I'll take off my chairman hat, and that is I want to remind people that we have an incredible, dangerous fire season ahead of us this year. The fires that occurred last week and this week in Reno because of the fuel loading that occurred in the state of Nevada is tremendous, and I'm just asking everyone to practice caution. It is reported that one of the fires, and I believe it was the Pyramid Lake fire, was possibly alleged to be started by practice shooting. So just please be careful if you're shooting, if you're being outdoors. Just, and I'm sure Mr. Paul, if he wanted to add to that, could add for about an hour on that topic. Please be careful. It's going to be a bad fire season.
If I could.
Oh, absolutely.
Just a sentence that defensible space is the, if folks at home are watching this, defensible space is where it's at. Have your game plan. Put together a go pack of whatever pharmacy items that you have, pills, and important papers. And build that defensible space now, and then firefighters will have a much better opportunity to save your property. From personal experience, I've had to drive by houses and say, I can't save that one, but I can save that one because of defensible space. I don't like to ever have to make that determination, but firefighters will have to. So and defensible space and a plan on where you're going. What about your pets, et cetera? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So, Mr. Chair, if I may, there's a great example of that just the other day in Reno, where a homeowner did a stand-up job planning stuff that was within the defensible space plan. I mean, it was textbook what is recommended in that plan. And lo and behold, I mean, the fire burnt right up to their property. They didn't get one iota of damage whatsoever. They were able to manage it. They had a good green belt. That good water supply out to the outer edges of the property, textbook what it should be. So I absolutely concur with Member Powell on that and you as well.
Well, that was a good public comment. Thank you all. Seeing no more public comment, would call for a motion on item number 17, action to adjourn.
So moved.
A second? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Thank you very much.
For a minute, I thought we were back at the Senate.
All right, Bill. Good to see you.
I think Thank you. We'll definitely bring that up.